If you survived it, you're proof of it. If your body is telling you it's true in some way or another. And knowing that those tellings have validity in themselves.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Rebecca Salazar, a poet, editor, and community organizer currently residing in Atlantic Canada. Rebecca's debut poetry collection, Sulphur Tongue, overflows with images of the poet's childhood and adolescence, of their traumas and resiliencies tested over and over again. Rebecca Salazar is the author of the poetry chapbooks The Knife You Need to Justify the Wound and Guzzle. Rebecca, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you, Lauren, and thank you for having me.
Of course. Will you read the poem that opens your collection?
Yes, I can. Synesthesia. Your name pronounced feels stark against your teeth like cold and cloves. A paper cut smell is the way the knife nicks a half-ripe peach pit. It tastes the way it feels to dig a nail into a maple's wet green seed peeled slowly from its husk. The body knows that being pinched on the neck or on the wrist tastes like landing on your tailbone after falling down the stairs, and knows the color of the cry that surges crackling up your spine is not the color of the hardwood floor, but is like that word, hardwood. Shiny, dark, with fire smothered in the gloss.
Thank you. Rebecca, tell me about synesthesia and how it appears in your life day to day.
Yeah, it's something I've learned about on and off since my childhood. I think I read a kid's nonfiction story somewhere where a kid had synesthesia where they could taste words. And I realized all words, numbers, colors, sounds have colors to me. And I thought that was normal. I thought everyone did that, but it turns out not so much. Although a lot more people do it as kids and then kind of lose track of it as they age. It's something that I definitely use to learn English. I started school in a bilingual French-English school without either language. I spoke Spanish, which is my family language. And yeah, it was just I was just thrown into a bunch of other languages that I started to distinguish how things were spelled or how things sounded just by remembering what colors they were to me.
How does it operate in the book as a whole then?
Yeah, I think it kind of forms an internal structure for me more than anything. I placed that poem first, partly because I couldn't figure out where it fit in the sections entirely, but it also felt like this is almost like a statement on how the perspective of the speaker is through the book. Everything is really sensory, senses blend together a lot throughout. It's always very visual, I think, just by virtue of that's how I process the world. When I started sorting through poems, that was a big part of how I went about it, was actually reading through everything and spreading things out on my floor and kind of sorting okay, if I start to think of these poems that kind of have warmer tones, what if those go together? And then checking if thematically that made sense. And eventually it kind of did. And it took a lot of back and forth and particular sections. I think of the last section as a lot of blue and gray tones. And that did tend to kind of group together all the poems about Sudbury, Ontario, my hometown, and kind of the landscape there. So it did work out. It has a kind of logic, even though it's completely irrational and non-empirical.
Sulphur Tongue is composed of four sections, and the book itself clocks in at over 100 pages, which is a pretty substantial book of poetry, actually. And you sort of just answered my initial question, which was how did you organize the collection? And I love that synesthesia helped in that endeavor. Beyond that, how do you feel these four sections cohere, apart from, of course, them being written by you and about your experiences?
Yeah, I think I think some of the similarities I found between poems were chronological. Like I definitely wrote a lot of the poems that ended up in similar sections around the same time because I was preoccupied with particular topics or forms. Like I think it's the third section, Doppelbanger, which originally was a lot of the poems I put in my first chapbook, Guzzle. And those poems had kind of been grouped together because they were all written around the same time in that sort of like five couplet format, like very associative logic. And they were written from fragments at a point in my life where I didn't have like time or literally short-term memory to write anything beyond like a couple of sentences at a time. And after that, it was way after that that I like started composing them into like groupings that felt right. So like on a much smaller scale, that same idea of like, do these match together and just like puzzle piecing until things like coalesce into poems.
I do want to talk to you about the way that you may be or might be expected to perform your traumas and your marginalizations because you write about them. But I want to make sure that you're okay with talking about that too.
Yeah.
You know, because books are public objects, right? They are consumerist objects. People are consuming them in ways that might be triggering to people who are writing about trauma and abuse. How do you take care of yourself in these spaces, in interviews like this one, in public readings, in classrooms, online, all of these very public spaces? How do you ensure that your poetry can remain private when it needs to be, but that you're prepared for its very public life as well?
Mm-hmm. The one that's most internal, I think, is knowing that there's a version of the poem that exists for me and for me only, and that the version that I send out to readers or publish or choose to publish is always, the way that I think of it is it has to still be 100% true. It need not be 100% accurate. So I definitely like fictionalize or mash stories together or experiences together or people together into the poems to make them, first of all, like a more coherent narrative, if there's a narrative involved. But also there's like a layer of adding surrealism or a distance that kind of like keeps me behind a veil if I need to be. And if I needed a particular version of the poem that didn't really have that layer of safety, I can hang on to that and keep that for myself. It doesn't mean I didn't write it. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But sometimes that's just safer to keep to myself. The other part of that is the public part of it. And I've definitely been lucky so far, like in terms of not being asked to just like, tell us about your trauma. Like I haven't gotten questions like that so far. And I hope never to get those, but I know I've gotten them before for other projects, or I know other writers who write about similar things, about being racialized, about being queer, about being a survivor of violence. Like you immediately get a weird barrage of questions that you could basically just like turn into a bingo card. They tend to fall into a lot of cliches. I'm gonna give some credit to Leah Horlick here, who's another amazing writer in what's known as Canada. She is lately working as the writer in residence for Open Book, which I believe is based in Toronto. And on their website, she's kind of started publishing a series of advice columns almost for self-care tips for writers, especially for emerging writers. And her most recent one, I think, actually was just about how to keep yourself safe online and negotiating that line between the public and the private and how much of yourself you choose to share, whether in the poetry, whether in an online presence, if you choose to have one, or at events even. So that's something that I think Leah is being incredibly articulate about, it's an ongoing issue, and it's something that doesn't get addressed in writing communities very often, let alone in quote-unquote training programs like MFAs and things like that, which they prepare you for some things that are very specific, but I think they miss out entirely on that.
I mean, I have like a comment on the book as a whole, because it does feel like a book that centers care, right? You're talking about communities, you're talking about family, your positions in family, whether it's chosen, ecological, you're talking about these kinships that center and really prioritize care. And so I think it's interesting that you find self-care practices so integral to your writing practice and to your public persona.
Yeah, I think that maybe, I don't know if that preoccupation was always there in the poetry, but it's definitely always been there for me as a person writing, partly because a lot of these poems originated when I don't think I was actually receiving the kinds of care I needed in a lot of ways as a writer, as a person. But then there were definitely a few mentors who kind of came along the way, and largely because I've had the privilege to be in a writing program through a lot of the writing of this, who showed up basically just at the perfect moment. Big credit to Ross Leckie for supervising a lot of the first part of the book in its original form. Like, the first part is a radically rewritten version of what I wrote for like an MA in creative writing, which at the time I didn't realize, like, despite the guidance I was getting from Ross, which was like so kind and deeply understanding, I personally wasn't writing for the right audience. I didn't know who my audience was meant to be. And I think I was writing a lot of those immigration and family poems for an audience of white people that I thought I was supposed to write for. It's something I had seen kind of done in like a lot of, especially Canadian writing communities, where basically immigrant writers or writers of color only get any kind of praise or publication, for that matter, if they write a particular version of the immigrant narrative. And I think in the process of writing those poems, I was definitely kind of becoming more critical of that atmosphere and of that demand for a particular kind of trauma performance. I kind of did like a little study at the end of the project of a bunch of particularly novels, but some poetry collections as well by immigrant writers, first and second generation, who had written some version of their immigration narrative for their family, which was a wide gamut of different stories with different events and different relationships from different countries and moving for different reasons. But the way that they were talked about in reviews or on public forums like Canada Reads that the CBC runs, things like that, they were all kind of being reduced to this one particular narrative, which was hardworking family moves because of traumatic event. The novel starts with the writer slash person that represents the writer in the book as an adult reflecting back on something they've repressed, and then it goes back in time and then catches up to the present, and there's something in a ravine in Toronto, and then a resolution. And like, it was the way that they were all talked about was just so reductive. And I was just noticing that complete erasure of the actual and not buzzword diversity of these stories, like the differences and the uniqueness and the brilliance of these stories was just being sapped right out of them, I think, by that kind of discourse. And I realized like I was buying into it. I was trying to sell myself into it because I was told that was what I had to do because I wasn't a white writer. I definitely had that impression that I couldn't write about anything else. I had to write about this. And part of me did want to, but not entirely for the right reasons until I actually dove into rewriting it many years later.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Canadian poet, editor, and community organizer Rebecca Salazar. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Can you tell us a little bit about Sudbury, Ontario, and where it sits in the book, how it has imprinted on you?
Yeah, Sudbury is a very strange place. It is literally a meteor crater. It is a hole in the ground in northern Ontario, about 5 hours north of Toronto, if you know where that is. it's cold most of the time. The seasons range from very extreme cold to very hot in the summer. It's a very rocky Cambrian Shield area. A lot of pine trees, a lot of conifers, which actually weren't there about 40 years ago. Basically, the history of the region is because of the meteorite impact how many millennia ago. It's a very mineral-rich region, which means there's a huge mining industry. And there was also a very significant logging industry. So very quickly between logging and the mining, smelting pollution, there used to be like open smelter pits all over the area. The trees all died, to the point where there are stories about this that are much more well-researched than I am. I think there's a CBC segment about this, but like the astronauts for one of the Apollo missions in the 60s, I believe, visited Sudbury to train for the moon landing because it was the closest environment they could think of to the moon. It was a wasteland. All the rocks were stained black. They still are from all the acid rain that happened. It was a very strange place, especially back then. What happened since was this massive effort, ironically enough, mainly led by the mining companies, to re-green, which means that most of the region is fairly young forest on top of all this black rock. So it's kind of got this surreal, I would say probably a little gothic or horror tinged tone to it. It's a land that's like full of lakes. It's Anishinaabe land. It's Ojibwe land. It's got those histories buried underneath it. There were residential schools in that region where indigenous people were assimilated, converted, quote unquote, their history is destroyed. And that layering of history is this like cosmic event that caused a crater, this violent colonial past, these like really toxic industries result in this place that is both really ugly at times and also strikingly beautiful at others. It's got this sublime character to it that growing up in it, you just feel like this is a really gray place. And it smells like sulfur all the time. Most of the time, I should say. It's a bizarre intersection of so many layers of history, I think. And that's one of the ways that I got really fixated on that, because it's visible. Like, I remember being driven on the bus to school and seeing the slag heaps in the distance, which are these like massive black hills of just like runoff from ore. And if you go past them at the right night on the right time of night on the highway, you can see the slag pouring down. So you see like molten metal going down these black hills, and it looks like, because of the way the crucibles are shaped, it kind of looks like these long humanish figures.
So speaking about family, specifically biological family in the book, broadly, there are a lot of really painful topics in the book, and some of them in relationship to that biological family. What is the triangulation between you, your family, and those sentiments expressed in the book? You know, mom, dad, I wrote this book, you're in it. What does that conversation look like in your family?
Really interesting at times, because like some of the stories are old family stories, like especially in that first section, there are a lot of poems that are based on kind of just oral myths that every family has, but ours were of a particular kind. There's that one story early on, I think, about an ancestor on my mom's side who lived through a civil war in Colombia and at one point had to hide under a dead man's body for some days while the armies were passing by, and the rebel armies were basically killing everyone they could, not to say much about the police doing any better. But yeah, that story from early childhood, like hearing that background really struck me, and little details about these stories always stuck with me. And they kind of became like a bit of an obsession or a haunting of a kind that like, I spent years actually for that story trying to research like which war was this? When would that have been? What street would it have been on? What day would it have happened on? And I wasn't able to find any documentation. Part of the obstacle is that most of that research is hard to access. The information there might be is hard to access from Canada, particularly just like database wise. There is a bit of a language barrier in that my Spanish isn't as great in writing as it is in speech, which like it's still pretty tenuous at times. Yeah, it was difficult to access any accuracy, at which point I had to ask myself, why do I want empirical evidence of these stories when what matters is that they're being told in this family? The details that matter have been preserved. And it was this idea of doing anything you can to survive. And like that theme of survival, I think, comes up a lot in the stories my family tells itself over and over. And I've been unpacking that slowly. I don't think I'll ever be done with it because those stories keep going. Whether I put them in a poem or tell them on a radio show, I don't think those stories are ever solid or static. They keep growing through every telling. So even though there's a poem with like set words to it, that I don't think that means the story is done or definitive. It's something that I find myself still thinking about in what I'm writing about now, which is definitely more since this book, everything I've been writing pretty much is about recovering from the trauma of sexual violence, and particularly the trauma of not being believed and being asked to be evidence or be proof, to prove it, whatever that means. And that whole insistence on particular kinds of proof and the ways of knowing that characterize a lot of Western institutions, a lot of white supremacist institutions, particularly, they aren't modes of proof that are available, let alone transferable across cultures. They definitely have sort of an agenda built into them in that they only accept kinds of knowledge that are decided to be worthy. And that immediately translates into only benefiting people who are deemed to be worthy. So that preoccupation with ideas of proof and empirical accuracy or whatever that might be, proving whether something quote unquote actually happened and like backing it up, which is also like part of academia too, is something I've definitely become more skeptical of. And just going back to that proof of like, if you survived it, you're proof of it. If your body is telling you it's true in some way or another. And knowing that those tellings, I think, have validity in themselves, whether or not they fit sort of a more dominant idea of what true is.
What has always struck me about your poetry is its ability in tone, in language, in voice to sort of misdirect emotion, right? Because so much of your poetry is about pain or an abuse of trust, emotional or bodily. But as you say, it's very punny sometimes or sarcastic in the way that makes me or, another reader kind of like, okay, wait a second. Like this speaker is grounded, right? They have a handle on things. There is a confidence there. What was the evolution of that tone, that voice, that punny character?
Yeah, this was something that took a while to kind of surface in my poetry. Because again, it was one of those things I wasn't sure I was allowed or supposed to do. I thought for a long time that poetry had to be serious and stoic or solemn in tone, which there are moments for that. But those aren't the default voice that I think or speak or write in, it turns out. There were a few friends who kind of like encouraged me to go in that direction, to just like embrace the weird and let myself go in those directions. I, for a long time, thought I was going to be a Shakespeare scholar, but it turned out I really was drawn to Shakespeare studies just because I like the punning available in the field. And that was always just like a form that appealed to me because it's so crass on the surface level, but it's really strategic. And it has that ability to kind of like play with a double meaning and make you think that you're going in one direction and then immediately reverse that. But also, it has the ability to hold two meanings simultaneously, I think. And that's one of the most powerful things about puns, which like doesn't get credited a lot. And I'm very much like making serious a thing that is very silly. But that silliness, I think, is part of what's important in it, is being able to hold two meanings, even if they're difficult or disgusting or awkward or problematic and still be able to laugh through it. Yeah, I think a big part of it for me, especially when writing difficult poems, I find myself getting more and more drawn to puns or bad jokes, like as a way of communicating difficult things, because it's got this sort of like survival in spite of feel. I've been thinking a lot about survivor humor as a way of coping with trauma. There are so many comedians who talk about this. Hannah Gadsby's Nanette is really brilliant on this. There's some writing around, I don't know if you've seen Promising Young Woman, Emerald Fennell's movie, which is, I think, a masterpiece of survivor humor. And that is exactly why it rankles everyone else who doesn't share the experiences that are being discussed. It's funny if you've been through it and survived. It's not funny for any other reason. And I think that's what it is, that ability to like turn around and laugh at the people who tried to dehumanize you or a situation that tried to dehumanize you. Laughter is such a human thing, and it's unruly and rebellious at times, but it's also silly and joyful. And I think the ability to maintain that even in the most difficult scenarios is like one of the only things that's gotten me through a lot of things, but also it's a strategy for like sharing that.
Can you tell listeners how you use tongue imagery or images of the mouth more broadly in these poems?
That's something I've never really thought about much. I didn't notice that I did it so much until the title fell into place, which took forever to decide on, actually. But yeah, I know I've played a lot with that strangeness in English of tongue meaning both the thing in your mouth, that muscle, that strange muscle that you speak with, and also language, like speaking in tongues, etc. That idea that language is so physical. And like language, like the word language already has like the Latin root for like long or like tongue in it. So it's not entirely just English, but I find that like directness of it, that coincidence in English, really fixating. I'm gonna like defer to Lucas Crawford here, who gave a talk about culinary arts and particularly avant-garde chefs who make particular kinds of art out of food. And at one point he just kind of threw out the non sequitur that the mouth is the seat of the self. And I haven't been able to unthink that since. It's the place where you take in the world through food, through air sometimes. That idea that it's a contact point with the world and it's how we speak most of the time. It's how we communicate. There's like the intimacy of like having your mouth touched to another mouth, kissing or at a dentist or like in other weird scenarios. It always feels so intimate to have your mouth touched or looked at by other people. Yeah, it's kind of got this like eroticism and communication to it. It's sensory. It just showed up all the time in my book. And it is kind of ironic that ended up being the title, because like I wasn't even thinking about that when we were thinking about the title.
Look for more information about Rebecca at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Bethann Ostein. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.